missing this.
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network.
All right, so delighted to be joined by former Footballer of the Year, Stephen McDonald. Stephen, how are things?
Not too bad, Roland. Just trying to get back to some kind of normality, I suppose.
Oh, that's it. And unprecedented times in the GAA as much as anywhere else. And I know Kalevi had a bit of a tricky week there, but things all clear as of last night?
Yeah, thankfully. Obviously, you know, it's been well documented over the last week or so. We've had to close our gates, unfortunately, due to a couple of lads contracting COVID-19. But thankfully, since then, you know, there's been 150 negative test results have come back, and adhering to public health guidelines, we've been allowed to open our gates again, which is brilliant.
I mentioned at the top, former Footballer of the Year, and across the water, there's been a bit of contention around Footballer of the Year in on the soccer side of things. Stephen, I know you're a big Liverpool fan, but Jordan Henderson, worthy winner, is he the best footballer in the Premier League?
Listen, this one is always going to be up for debate. I think he's a fantastic player. I think he's improved a hell of a lot over the last couple of years. And, you know, people question his ability sometimes. But for me, you know, he's been the captain of Liverpool since Steven Gerrard retired. And he gets the captaincy of the England national team when Harry Kane isn't playing or isn't fit. So he doesn't get those, you know, rewards for nothing. He obviously adds a lot to a team in terms of his leadership qualities. So he led Liverpool excellently all year. You know, you can see the drive that he has on the pitch on match days, and he certainly pushes Liverpool to extra levels. Was he the best player this year? I would have him up in the top three. I think Liverpool's most outstanding player this year has been Sadio Mane. I think he probably deserved it a wee bit more.
And I know you're a fervent Liverpool fan. Would it affect you? Are you so much so that if they lose, it kind of, not that they've lost that much this year, but would it ruin your day, or can you take it or leave it?
No. I get upset. Unfortunately, I think maybe since I've retired from playing, I've become more of a Liverpool fan. And yeah, it does kind of bug you and annoy you a wee bit. And I suppose when you're involved in the team sport, you learn to deal with the ups and the highs and lows. And you know, over the years with Liverpool, we've certainly learned to deal with the lows quite a lot. So it's just nice when they're on a winning run that they have been on, and it's obviously disappointing them when that comes to an end. So you do be annoyed with their defeats.
And just on Jordan Henderson, it's often in team sports, I presume, and you can speak to this, those consistent players who turn up every week and put in a solid 7 or 8 out of 10 are almost as important as the flashy players that maybe catch the eye of the public that bit more.
Absolutely. You know, in team sport, you need, it's horses for courses. You know, Jordan Henderson couldn't slot into centre-half the way Virgil van Dijk plays it. He couldn't slot in a striker's role the way Mohamed Salah has slotted into it. You know, it's being the best in the position that you're picked in and playing the role to the best of your ability that the manager sends you to do. And, you know, you can see Jordan Henderson's role within the Liverpool team. And it's also when he's on the field to be that, I suppose, that force to continuously drive the team forward and to not accept second best standards. And while you know, you'd look throughout the Premier League and you'd see many more talented centre midfield players, you wouldn't see too many more that would drive and I suppose make his team push forward and keep them at the top for as long as what he has this year, the way Jordan Henderson does it. And you know, every position is certainly different, so it is, and you just have to get the best out of the players that play in them.
Yeah, and when it's all said and done, 30 years of hurt, they've been to four Champions League finals and won two, so it hasn't been too bad, but he's the one that got them over the line in the Premier League. And You would have been 11 when the last one at Stephen.
And I can remember it too, believe it or not. I would have been around that time a huge John Barnes fan, and you know, he was at the prime of his career, particularly back then. I can remember Kenny Dalglish being the manager, even though I was very, very young. You can still remember, but it was a long time to wait. And you know, when you have a lot of success the way Liverpool had in the 70s and 80s, you expect that that winning run is always going to continue. And for them to go 30 years without a league win, you know, you wouldn't have expected that to be the case. But you know, Liverpool 10 years ago were a team that were almost in administration, and the transformation has been absolutely unbelievable. I would put a lot of that down to the management skills of Jurgen Klopp, of course, over the last 5 years, and how he's managed to get the best out of the side, how he's managed to attract world-class players to the team, and the transformations have certainly turned on his head. And, you know, you look at even the 90s and the noughties and the dominance of Man United. It's been 7 or 8 years since they've won it. You know, they probably won't go 30 years, but it's very difficult to maintain those high standards through a long period of time. And Liverpool certainly found that out the hard way.
It's interesting you mentioned Klopp as well. I'd be interested to hear some of your own coaching outlooks. But I mentioned 11-year-old Stephen McDonald there, and I know you were a bit of a soccer prodigy in your earlier years. Was Anfield ever the dream? Was that ever your number one goal to be a soccer player, or was winning All-Ireland for Armagh always your number one target?
Listen, when you're young and you're playing both Gaelic and soccer, you want to enjoy playing the sport as much as possible. It was probably when I was around 16 or 17 I became more competitive at soccer. But the reality was I was a much better Gaelic footballer than what I was at soccer. And my first love was always Gaelic football. And you know, the better I got at it and the elder I got, the more focused I became on trying to break my way into the Armagh setup. And winning in All-Ireland was always a dream, of course, but you know, it was only really until you actually get yourself involved with the senior setup that it becomes a real ambition. And I suppose it was around the time when I was 18, 19 and breaking into the squad, that's when it really became an ambition. And seeing the quality of players that we had around us and knowing that we had the ability to drive forward and to basically get there.
But there were scholarships on the table, weren't there, for soccer? Like, that was an avenue you could have wanted to.
That was. And the timing of it was all wrong, I suppose. I was offered a scholarship to head to the States and play, but I was home for the Christmas break, and I got the opportunity to go and train with the Armagh senior team, and I never looked back, and that was it. And you know, there was once or twice I went in and played with Glenavon, and they were looking to, after a year of playing with Armagh seniors, Glenavon were looking at me to go straight into the first team. I hadn't played soccer in a year, and there was no way that was happening. I went and played a few reserve games, played reasonably well, but I ended up giving it up because I knew where my first love lay, and I was more inclined to drive forward in my Armagh career than any other soccer career.
I find it interesting as well, especially nowadays. David Clifford's probably the best example of this, where when there's young talents like that in a certain county, you see all these viral videos of them kicking points or scoring goals in their early teens. Obviously, that wasn't the case when you were coming through, but would you have been a known commodity coming through? Like, would people have known, oh, Stephen McDonald's going to be in the Armagh senior team in 10 years? Or was it, what was the progression like?
Yeah, well, I was fortunate in my underage playing days that I played in a very, very successful Cleeby side. We would have dominated Armagh club football at every age level, from under-10s the whole way up to under-21s. So I was winning regularly, and we were competing against the likes of Cross McGlenns at that time, who had the McEntees and Paul Hardy players to get playing. And we were regularly beating them in finals. And I suppose back then, I was a free taker. I would have been the first choice free taker for the club side, and coming into the Armagh underage teams, I would have been the first choice free taker. Would people have seen me as potential Armagh senior star? I don't think so, because back then I was extremely light, and I wouldn't have been carrying any muscle at all. And people probably would have seen it as a case of, no, he's not strong enough to play county football. The reality is, when I became involved with the senior setup, I was playing with extremely big, powerful men. When you look through the the group of lads that were there, Kieran McGeaney, Kieran Hughes, Paul McGrain. The reality is, you know, I had to learn to win dirty ball against these guys and, you know, come out clean with it and be able to lay it off and play football. And if I was able to do it in the training field, then I felt that I could improve and move forward in my career. And that's what happened.
Hmm. And 1999, such a big year. It really kicked off an unbelievable decade for Armagh football. Did you sense, even as a young person, and I appreciate that you were new to the setup, but did you sense there was something in the offing in that regard, that Armagh were on the brink of something?
I knew after a short period of time of going in and training with the lads that they were very driven and very hungry. '99, I came in January '99, so I realised very soon after coming in that I wasn't going to play much of a part in that particular season. So I was generally cornerback in training that whole campaign, and I didn't mind it, to be honest. When I always look back at my career, I always felt that I learned a lot from playing cornerback and coming up against corner forwards and how they would play and approach the game. But I suppose the biggest thing that made me believe that this Armagh team could kick on, we got to a National League semi-final and got beat by Dublin. And if you're getting to that stage, you know that you can go on and compete at a higher level. And then overcoming Donegal after coming back and drawing with them in the first game in 99 was a massive step in the right direction for that Armagh squad, and end up kicking on and really taking Ulster by storm for the next couple of years. But that 99 win was a massive progressive step for Armagh.
And getting over that provincial hurdle, did it feel like, right, the target going into a season was let's win Ulster? When did that target become we can be the best team in the country? Because obviously Armagh had never won an All-Ireland before. Yeah. Too, so it's a big statement to make, but I'm sure speaking amongst yourselves in team meetings, you were thinking we have a chance here, especially like 2000 was probably significant in the sense that, as you mentioned with the league, that bringing Kerry to a replay and really pushing them all the way showed Armagh at the top table and we're really not that far away.
Yeah, well, 99, if I'm being realistic, the main aim would have been to win an Ulster title, because we hadn't won one in 17 years and none of that squad had won an Ulster title, so we had to be realistic, and that was the main topic on the agenda in 99. But when you kick on and then you go on and win Ulster in 2000 for the second year in a row, then you become really serious about looking at towards winning All-Ireland. And you know, we put in two real classic games against Kerry in the All-Ireland semi-final, and they went on and won it. Like the year before, Meath beat us in the semi-final, and you know, as a squad, we would feel that we didn't play to our best on that particular day, but they went on and won the All-Ireland. So we had been beaten by the two teams who kicked on and won the All-Ireland. So we knew we were knocking on the door and we weren't a million miles away, and if we could just tweak one or two things, then we could certainly get that step closer. And but 2000, the ambition certainly switched from winning an Ulster to winning All-Ireland in comparison to 1989.
Yeah, and even 2001, Galway were the team that knocked Armagh out and they went on and won the All-Ireland, so it just shows you. But the 1990s is an interesting decade for Ulster football. I know Enda McNulty and Enda McGinley were on recently and they were talking about how the success of the Down team in particular showed that Ulster football is right in the mix. And I know you grew up very near to Newry and you would have seen probably those parades and stuff. Did that even trigger something in your generation, your mind, that, geez, I'd love a bit of that with Armagh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I went where Down were coming across the border to the Carrickdale in 91. I was only 11, or I was 12 at that time. I went up there to see them coming down and the thousands upon thousands of people that were there supporting them on. And then in 94 again, I was under the Clog Bridge, which I'm from a place called Clog, which is in Cleavey, and that's the first part of call basically as they're going down in towards Newry, and I followed the team down to Bordercrane where they stopped off and got onto the back of a trailer, and you know, thousands upon thousands of people get there again. And that I suppose from a very young age was look back in that Down team and have huge admiration for what they went and achieved in the early 90s, and the players, and I've become good friends with a lot of those players, and it's, you know, even watching game back there in recent weeks, and they were fantastic footballers and, you know, real hard men and played the game the way you want the game to be played. But ultimately they went up to Croke Park expecting to win, and you know, that drive and that tunnel vision to have success and taste success can only be admired.
Not to discredit the management teams that went before, because you mentioned Ulster titles won by Armagh, but
yeah,
how big an impact did Joe Kernan have when he arrived in for that 2002 season?
Massive, but like, I wouldn't take away the impact that the two Brians had also. You know, the two Brians instilled the belief for Armagh. They probably kick-started the belief for Armagh to go on and be competitive on a national level, and winning a couple of Ulsters under them certainly instilled that belief to do that. But we did need to tweak things around a wee bit, and Joe came in, he made changes. He brought in a huge backroom team, brought in statisticians. He brought us away to Linga. He brought in a liaison manager that was second to none, but he was prepared to take risks as well, Joe. And you know, throwing in the likes of Ronan Clark in 2002, you know, I couldn't have seen the two Brians throwing in Clarkey, but Joe seeing something in Clarkey at such a young age, to know that he trusted him enough to go into the big match and perform at a high level, and that was the case. And but the confidence that Joe brought with him, you know, we from our point of view as players, we were looking at a very successful club manager who'd won three All-Irelands with his club, Cross McGlenn. And if you can get them across the line, having never gone and achieved that before, then he can certainly get us across the line. And he came in, and his skills and preparation was second to none. And, you know, if Joe felt that he wasn't strong in one department, he would get somebody in that was stronger. And that was a huge attribute that he had as well.
And Cross McGlenn, it's an interesting dynamic, I think, especially from the outside looking in. People probably can't fathom how the club scene works in Armagh, because as you mentioned, as a minor or underage player, you were going nip and tuck with them for most of those years, and yet for most of your senior career, presumably they were the only kids in town. So how did you reconcile that as a club player in Armagh, I just wonder?
I suppose back then, Cross McGlenn's toughest challenges were, believe it or not, in Armagh club ball. There were a number of teams that run them close. Clannagh would have been one, Drumtee in a few finals certainly would have been one. In 2004, we even drew with them in the championship match where we could have won. And, you know, against a team with the quality of Cross McGlenn, you have to take your opportunity the first day out. And like many good teams, they'll turn around and learn from their errors and mistakes the first day out and put that to bed the second day. And that's what they've done on numerous occasions. They drew many matches in the Armagh championship. So there was plenty of teams always believed that they can be competitive against Cross McGlenn. But it was just their experience and know-how. And, you know, I suppose when you go in against Cross McGlenn, even to the current day, you know, you almost give them a 3-4 point advantage just by looking at the jersey alone. But it shouldn't be the case. So it shouldn't be what it was back then. And I've seen it with certain teams right now, that they still give them that advantage in their heads. But, you know, it wasn't a case that we felt that Cross McGlenn were always going to win the championship. They always believed that they were, but we didn't feel that was the case. But they ended up going on and doing what they believed that was going to happen anyway.
So Joe comes in with all that Cross McGlenn experience, but you look at that Armagh team and it's obviously incredible looking back to some of the senior figures on it and the leadership group that would have been there. So he brought in the Cross McGlenn ethos. They were obviously well represented on the team. But the leadership group had players from all clubs. So there must have been a huge buy-in that we can put our club rivalry, quote-unquote, to one side and knuckle down for Armagh here.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose that Armagh team was represented by clubs the length and breadth of Armagh. And, you know, there was a huge bond that was formed between that group. And, you know, clubs were put to one side while we were together, and that was it. Yes, we were competitive against each other when we played and performed against each other, to put that to bed and make sure that Armagh was the priority.
And we mentioned how close the game in years leading up to 2002, but in 2002, things, the ball bounced away a little bit more. Sligo game was close, and then the Dublin game, Ray Cosgrove, obviously that free goes a little bit further to the left. It's probably a replay, but things seemed to go Armagh's way, and you were forcing the issue a lot more, and it felt like you were the team in control almost. But then coming up against Kerry, always a daunting task. Was there ever a point in that season where you thought, right, this is it, we're finally on the right track here, we're going to do it? Or did you not believe it until the final whistle?
Well, I suppose there's a great quote you hear: the harder I train, the luckier I get. And that year, we felt that we trained better and harder than anybody else be prepared better than any other team that was in the country, and that includes Kerry. And even though we only beat them by a point, we still, our preparation was night and day, in our opinion, ahead of the pack. And you know, we felt that we were handed the possible draw in the first round of the championship against Tyrone, because we didn't need any other motivation. They were the National League champions. They had a young team coming through the ranks that were very successful at minor and under 21 level and had won all Ireland's those grades. So if we could go and beat them, then we knew that we were on the right track. And we went into the first round game as underdogs and put in a performance where they scored a goal in the last minute to draw the game. And a lot of people believe that we missed the boat that first day out. But we came back bigger and stronger and learned a lot from the first day, and ended up beating them in the replay. And that was a game that really instilled a lot of belief in us as a team, and we kicked on. And after that, really, without, I suppose, underestimating the rest of our opponents in Ulster, I personally felt that there was no other team in Ulster, if we maintained our focus, was going to stop us winning Ulster that year. And that was the case. And we ended up beating Fermanagh in the semi-final and then Donegal in the Ulster final. And then kicking on to the Sligo game, we were very, very lucky. In a game, it's funny when you look back, you get off to a brilliant start and then you fall into the trap of allowing your opponents to pick off score by score and get themselves back into the game. That was one of those games. But Sligo had the momentum towards the end of that game. And when you have momentum, it's very hard to sway it back in your favour. And we all remember Darren McGarthy then going through on goal and up in the fist of ball over the bar, and you know, it gave us a lifeline, so did it certainly gave us a second chance. And I feel that if I was in that position going through a goal, you would at least have pulled the trigger to give it a shot and see if you got the goal or not. But thankfully Dara was thinking differently than what I would have been thinking, and we beat them in a replay up in Navan. There were still doubts about that Armagh team, because we'd gone to Croke Park from 99, but we still hadn't managed to win a championship game there. So for us to prove the doubters wrong, you know, it was critical that we had to go to Croke Park in a big game and come out victorious. And the game against Dublin, I always say, was, in terms of the atmosphere and just the occasion itself, two teams very evenly based in terms of where they were at. You know, Dublin were on a crest of wave that year, coming through under Tommy Lance, you know, beating opponents left, right and centre, and we had been there for a few years, but we knew we were coming up against a different type of Dublin team that was there in the last 6 or 7 years. And it really was a fantastic game of football. I'd be talking more about the second half, but because I haven't watched it recently again, I thought the first half was littered with mistakes, but the second half the game sprung to life and both teams very evenly balanced, going hell for leather at each other and playing out an epic semi-final. And it all boiled down to one kick at the end, and that wee bit of lady luck was still with us. And what I say about, you know, the harder I train, the luckier I get. You know, when that ball came off the post, there was 3 or 4 Armagh players around. The Dublin players didn't react to it, but we were the first to react to it, and that's why we deserved to go through to the final.
And that was your third season on the team. So you mentioned in 99 you were kind of a little bit wet behind the ears, learning your way on the panel, but by then you were someone who was relied upon, and there's obviously much made of Oisín McConnell's narrative in that game where he misses the penalty and then gets the goal, but people obviously forget, and it's worth reminding people that you kicked the winning point in that game. And was that a planned move, Stephen? Because it looked like there was some sort of trigger where you got onto your left foot to pop that over the bar.
Yeah, it was a planned move, but preferably I would have wanted it on my right foot. But listen, we played that type of diagonal ball the whole season. We worked on it in training, and that final move, the quality of pass made in O'Rourke into me, you know, it was the type of pass that a defender really can't get anywhere near. And to be able to turn as an inside forward and not have to take a bounce or a solo and know that you're within range of kicking the ball over the bar, is extremely hard to mark against, and that opportunity presented itself, and I was fairly comfortable off left or right foot, so I was happy enough to kick it over, and thankfully it did go over the bar. But there was 10 minutes left of that game, so we didn't expect that was going to be the last score of the match. But you know, Oisin's goal and where Oisin came from to score the goal after missing a penalty and all in the first half, and maybe having, I suppose, demons in his head at that particular time, you know, point thinking, you know, maybe you're going to be remembered for missing a penalty in the All-Ireland final, and kicking on and being able to put his focus into getting us the goal was a critical score. Obviously, we felt that we had to get a goal to get us back into the game, and it came at the right time. And from then on in, you know, the lucky breaks really started to fall our way, and we started to take control of the game. And it really did feel, even though it was an intense 15-20 minute spell, it really did feel that we were going to do enough to hold it out.
And it's interesting you mentioned the left foot, because, and I think this probably drives sports people mad, it'd be interesting to get your opinion on it, that, oh, Stephen McDonnell, he's natural off left and right foot. I presume you put an unbelievable amount of work in to be as good on your weaker foot as you were on your strong foot.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was coached by a great coach around Cleavey in my underage days called Thomas Mallon, and one of his main focuses was to work equally off both feet. And that's exactly what I'd done from a very young age. You know, I practiced religiously on my left side as much as I did on my right side, and it just became natural for me to be able to kick with both feet. And when I look back at my career, a lot of my scores, probably more of my scores, came off my left side. A lot of people seem to think that I was a left-footed player, but I wasn't. I was a right-footed player, and it's maybe not a bad sign. But you know, even nowadays, when you're trying to encourage some of the younger players to work off both feet, and you see them dropping the ball a wee bit differently onto their weaker side than what they would on their stronger side, and nothing really changes, and that's the key thing to it. You know, the ball still drops the same way from your hands to your foot. You still strike the ball the exact same way, and if you can practice and hone in on that and learn to deal with that, then we can have more two-footed players throughout the country, and that's what I'd love to see. You know, it's an extremely hard trait to mark against if you're a two-footed footballer. You know, even as a defender, you never know where you're going to turn, and having that in your locker can only be beneficial for any player in the future, and that's something that I would love to see more of, is more coaches focusing from a very early age on both left and right-footed kicking.
So you swing that point over the bar with your slightly weaker left foot, and then, as you mentioned, there's 10 minutes of unbelievable tension. Like, even watching it back recently, that it's sort of, Armagh weren't hanging on to a 1-point lead, but just the way it transpired, there were no more scores in that game. And then the image is obviously McGeaney with the ball, falls to his knees, and that's it. But there's some lovely images of you with your family just as the crowds are coming onto the pitch. Like, is that as good as it gets, Stephen? Was that the...
Seeing the sea of orange and white coming onto the field, you know, you're just full of joy. You don't really know where you're at. It's a place that we've never been before, and you're lifted up on the people's shoulders, and you're just trying to enjoy the moment as best you possibly can. And it happened to be, when we were walking up the Hogan steps, I see my future wife to be. So it was brilliant to meet people that you love, and you went through a long, hard road to get there, and they're waiting for you at the steps. But that was brilliant. It was fantastic. Sea of emotion and wave of emotion. And, you know, if you could turn the clock back, you'd just love to relive it all again.
You name-checked Ronan Clark a little bit earlier. I'm not sure how long he had been around the panel. Obviously, very young player at the time. And he won Young Player of the Year in 2002. Colm Cooper was the big thing at the time, and people were talking about him in that final, but it was Ronan Clark who really had an unbelievable season. And strike partnerships are obviously a very common thing in soccer, but I always thought you and him had a bit of a Shearer and Sheringham type thing going on. Did you really enjoy playing with him?
Yeah, he was a fantastic player to play alongside. You know, we were lucky enough that we were given time to form that partnership together, you know, and we were both pretty young. I was the second or third youngest player on that team, so we had plenty of years ahead of us to be able to get that partnership right. And I knew how Clarkie would play, and he knew how I would play. And even, you know, the wee deft touches that he would lay off to me, I knew exactly what he was doing probably just before he was doing it. And we played close together, so we did, and we knew how to play and link play together. And we just became so familiar with each other's game. And that happens on the nights upon nights on the training field as well. But I suppose one of the biggest compliments that we could have received, I was at a function in the City West one night. I think it might have been the All-Stars in 2006. And Jack O'Connor was managing Kerry at the time. And he says that after the first 15 minutes, we were creating that many headaches for him that he actually had to go around behind the goal and watch what exactly it was that me and Clarkie were doing to try to nullify that threat in the second half. And how he done that was by pulling, you know, three or four sweepers back in front of us, and it stopped the supply of ball coming in somewhat, but we were still able to get a few scores in the second half. But, you know, we did form a good partnership together, and Clarkie was a really brilliant teammate to play alongside.
And he had some big moments after that year. There's a game against Leash, I think it was a quarter final, where you and him kind of ran right a little bit, but he was a bit derailed by injuries in the end, probably never hit the heights he should have. Like, how big a miss was he, Stephen, in the last few years of that decade?
Clarkie was a great focal point for Armagh. He was a huge man, but equally as talented off his left foot as much as his right foot as well. He had great balance. He had a great sidestep, and he was just impossible to mark. You know, he could take a ball high or low, and he had a, you know, I always say a football brain. Clarkie had a football brain, and when you're losing that there from your side, you're losing a lot. So you are, and you know, there was players come in, and no disrespect to any of them, they're all fantastic players in their own right, but they weren't just as talented or as good as Ronan Clark. And Clarkie on his day was probably the most gifted full forward that was playing the game at that particular time, and unfortunate due to injuries, his career was cut short. But thankfully, Clarkie has stayed in the game, and he's now into coaching and management.
I was going to ask you, like, it's only natural that when you climb Mount Everest, there's a big exhale where you're like, we finally done it. I was going to ask you, did you take your foot off the pedal as a team the following year? But the fact that you got back to a final would suggest that definitely wasn't the case, and were it not for that unbelievable block by Conor Gormley, you could well have won back-to-back All-Ireland. So how do you reflect on that year now, Stephen? I know it was a really memorable year for you, Footballer of the Year and all that went with that, but how does 2003 stick in your mind?
2003, we were probably more focused on the All-Ireland than what we were 2002. After a week or so of celebrating the win in 2002, Joe got the focus straight back on, and his ambition then went from trying to win in All-Ireland to trying to go for two in a row, and that's where our focus as players went straight away. And yes, we were derailed somewhat in the first game against Monaghan, but we got back on track and we found our focus again. And I would say the 2003 campaign, in terms of how we played football, was probably more successful than what it was in 2002. Mm. We had that confidence and our belief about ourselves that we were going to beat any team in our way, and that's what we done the way to the final. And unfortunately for us, we didn't probably show up and play to our best in the final, and Tyrone fully deserved to win it. And that's the pain that you have to look back on. You know, at the end of the day, the team that turns up and performs best in the final deserved to win it, and Tyrone done that, and we just didn't do it. And that's just part and parcel of sport, and you have to move on. But overall, I feel that we played better as a team. Our performance levels was much greater than what it was in 2002.
Yeah, and you see in post-match interviews all the time when players have a good game, they try and downplay it and say it's all about the team, and it is a team game at the end of the day. But to win Footballer of the Year, Stephen, and three All-Stars, like, I'm sure that's an enormous source of pride for you as an individual.
Yeah, listen, all the awards that you pick up is a real source of pride, and I always look back at picking up those individual rewards and even man of the match rewards and all. I always look and try to share it out with the club as much as possible, you know, because a lot of my career was down to my underage early training and techniques that I was taught from the top class coach that I received in Clevey. And but ultimately, you know, to kick on and achieve on a personal level what I achieved with Armagh, you know, I would have never have expected that before my career begun. And you walk away with three All-Star Footballer of the Year, numerous monthly awards, all that comes along with it. But, you know, it's all fantastic, but you always give it all away for another All-Ireland, of course.
Mm. And there were a few days to stick out. I know the Wexford League final, 7 from play that day and 10 points altogether. And then a game in Limerick, or against Limerick in Roscommon, I think it was, where you scored a hat-trick. So you had some particularly noteworthy days as an individual. Were you kind of forward? I'm sure it comes with maturity, but I'm sure in your earlier days, you were probably, even if Armagh won, you were a little bit disappointed if you didn't manage to rack a few scores up. Did that change as your career went on?
Yeah, listen, I always say this, and I got to know it very early in my career. If you were number 10 to 15, your first responsibility for the team is to score. And if you don't do that, you're not carrying out your main task. And I think in my Armagh career, that I was held scoreless once in a league and championship. And so I didn't do too bad out of the scoring aspect of things. But the games that you mentioned there, the 10 points against Wexford and 3-4 against Limerick, are games that definitely stick out my mind. But some of my best individual performances probably came in league games in Crossmaglen. I can remember kicking 13 points against Westmeath. And unfortunately for Westmeath again, I remember scoring 3, 5 or 6 in a league game as well. And, you know, I suppose the Wexford and Limerick games spring to people's minds simply because one was National League final and the other was a championship match.
You mentioned throughout that decade and on paper, 7 Ulster titles, I think you won individually. Yeah. And that Armagh team is a defining team of this century so far. And yet to come away with one All-Ireland probably feels like you were a little bit shortchanged. Do you live with any regrets in that regard, Stephen?
I do and I don't. If you understand me, I look back and I think, did the back door come in at the wrong time for that Armagh team? If you win 7 Ulsters, you would certainly fancy your chances to win a few All-Irelands out of that. That's the system that was put in place at the time. You know, I look back on my career, 7 Ulsters, the individual awards, the National League Division 1, National League Division 2, All-Ireland medal. You know, that's nothing to be sniffed at, you know what I mean? I came in January 99. Martin McQuillan, Neil Smith retired in December 98, just before I came in. And unfortunately for those guys, they never even won an Ulster title. So I was lucky that I was part of a very successful Armagh team, the most successful Armagh team in the history of our game. And, you know, to win those rewards, you know, you look back with, you know, I suppose great enjoyment. Yes, we would have loved to have won other All-Irelands. Should we have won other All-Irelands? Absolutely. But being honest, I'm forever grateful for the All-Ireland that I did win and for the 7 Ulsters and whatever else we won along the way.
And you rode off into the sunset in 2012. Was it a very different game, Stephen, even then? I know sweepers and stuff had started to come in the early 2000s, but like nowadays, it's probably not quite the same game that you grew up playing, is it?
Well, it's certainly not with the amount of rule changes that have been implemented over the last couple of years. I don't think I would enjoy playing as much now than what I did throughout my career. The sweeper system never really bothered me, to be honest. Ultimately, from a forwards point of view, you've got to get yourself into an area where you can affect and impact the score zone. And that's what I always tried to do, regardless of the amount of bodies that were back and trying to protect that zone. But the way the game has gone, you know, probably around 2013, 14, 15, it was very negative, very defensive. But I think it's starting to turn the corner again, and more teams are playing a more attacking brand of football, which is fantastic to see. And we're seeing more kicking games as well, and that's exactly what you want. But the rule changes, I think, are probably a threat to our game at the minute and slowing the pace of our game down.
It's notable, just looking back to your career, when it was all said and done, you captained every team you ever played for. So what was the leadership style, Stephen, like having come through the likes of Kieran McGeaney and seen Paul McGrain do his thing? Like, how did you get your own captaincy across? Were you kind of lead by example kind of guy, or were you vocal in the dressing room?
Well, I learned a lot from the likes of Kieran McGeaney and Paul McGrain, and I was vocal when I had to be vocal, and I felt that I trained you know, I set the example on how I trained in terms of expecting the rest to follow suit. And, you know, the best example that I can use would be the time that I captained Ireland. I represented Ireland on four occasions before that, and it no longer became my ambition just to represent Ireland. I wanted to captain Ireland. And even though Kieran McGeaney, my own county and club mate, our county mate, had captained Ireland 4 years before that, I seen that there was an opportunity for me to do the same. And I travelled to Dublin and stayed in Dublin every weekend simply to captain Ireland, not just only to get onto the team, but I wanted to go and be the best trainer, the best leader on the field, lead by example in terms of my actions, what I was doing in terms of scoring, how I was setting play up, but also my communication skills. And that was rewarded when Anthony Doyle gave me the captaincy, and I felt justified that, you know, the couple of months of hard work paid through, because of I set myself a target on becoming the captain, and I got that. And, you know, for me it was down to the effort that I put on the training field and my ability to communicate with my teammates.
And speaking of individual accolades, I don't know if we've mentioned it yet, but I think you're the all-time top scorer for Ireland in international rules. So what was it about that code that sort of lent itself so well to you, Stephen? Because obviously you were able to get the soccer skills in on a few occasions. Yeah. Physicality, I'm sure you loved a bit of that as well. So was it just the perfect game for your skill set?
Yeah, I think I was a smart footballer. I think I played with my head a lot. I knew when to make a mark and when to play on. I knew how to create space and how to make a run into an area where the ball was going to be coming. And I think most of the time when I was playing against the Australians, I probably outsmarted them more than outplayed them, if you know what I mean. And yes, kicking over 100 points. In my last test, I think I went down to Australia with 92 points. And my aim was simply just to get enough in the two games to kick over 100 points and become the first player ever to do so. And I ended up at 118. And, you know, that is still the case, that no player has ever kicked over 100 apart from himself. So it's something that, you know, I'm extremely proud of. It's a great game that I love playing. I love forming relationships and partnerships with players from other counties. The likes of Benny Colden and myself and him formed a good relationship on the field as well, something similar to myself and Clarkie, and then with the likes of Kieran Donaghy, Stephen Cluxton, seeing it firsthand how the top players in the country played and performed and trained was brilliant to see and be part of as well.
Just before I let you go, I have to mention you're very much entrenched in the coaching circles now. I know you did a lot of underage stuff with Killeavy, you're under 21s with Armagh, now you're with Glenoe and Tyrone. I'm sure they welcomed you with open arms, Stephen, into the Tyrone footballing family. But how are you finding the coaching side of things? Was that always the intention to be a coach when you finished playing?
Yeah, well, I always wanted to stay involved. For me, there is a big difference in coaching and managing, and I have coached for a number of years, and I simply prefer managing, so I do. I was given the opportunity to manage in Clonoe, and I've been welcomed with open arms over the last couple of months. I've got a great group of lads that I'm working alongside, group of lads that you can really see want to listen and improve and try to play it to your way of thinking. And thankfully, we've had a decent enough start, and we're moving in the right direction. But I suppose I don't think the welcome will be just as great as I get to travel around to the other clubs in Tyrone. I think they'll probably find the hatred that they once had for me again.
You've touched on it there yourself, but are you encouraged by the standard of play you're seeing from corner forwards at the moment across the county game? Because Colin Cooper was on during the year saying, like, the one thing he tells corner forwards these days is patience, because you probably don't get your hands on the ball as much as you would have done in his era, for example. But what do you think of the current crop of corner forwards, and is attack and play coming back into it?
I think attack and play is coming back into it. Patience is always, you know, a great trait to have as a corner forward. From one game to the next, you can never tell how often the ball is going to come in or not, and you can be waiting 10 minutes for a ball to come in. And a lot of the time what you see is players start to drift out the field and lose their shape. And if players can hold their shape and keep that patience and do the right thing when the ball does come in, then the game will be in a better place. But I think there is with the mark, there's greater opportunities for corner forwards to get their hands on the ball. I just don't like the mark in Gaelic football. I think it slows the game down. I would rather see a corner forward in that position, maybe get the ball, win the ball in natural circumstances, and eyeball this corner back and say, I'm going to go at you here and try to take you on and create a scoring opportunity. And that's the way I like the game played, at a fast pace. But certainly patience has always been a critical skill to have as an inside forward. And I would be saying that to every player, you know, you've got to learn to keep your shape, hold your fort, and when the ball comes in, do the right thing with it. You know, keep focused and not be erratic when it comes in, because that's what you see a lot of the time, is a corner forward who hasn't touched the ball in maybe 5 or 10 minutes becomes erratic with what he does, and that's simply down to his thought process not working exactly the way you want it.
It's kind of come to the fore a little bit with the Dean Rock stuff. I don't know what your opinion is on that. His enterprise in the last couple of weeks, and even the GPA are in the headlines this week. And it always struck me that you were a player who was well aware of his value as a prominent sports figure in Ireland, that with the club energised thing, even the incident with your boots, where you were kind of making a point to Adidas that, you know, I'm going to prove a point here. I think you blacked out the Adidas stripe when you were trying to hammer down a deal. So you always struck me as someone who was very clued in before his time. What's your sense of how GA players are represented, and also the furore around the Dean Rock thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, listen, Dean Rock is the most recognisable free taker in our game at the minute. Who wouldn't want to have him coaching them and training them, regardless of the prices? You know, you can't expect an amateur person like Dean Rock to go and do that, giving up the good of his time simply by not charging for it. And, you know, the way I look at it, and the way I thought about this in the last couple of weeks, if, you know, parents are quite happy to pay teachers for tutoring their kids, you know, this is another example of kids and senior players being tutored by one of the best in the game. So for that reason, you know, he deserves to be paid, and whatever his charge is, that's fine by me. I have no problem with that there. But, you know, for a player who's come under a lot of criticism over the last week or two, I think it's unjustified. You know, he's been through the mill in terms of what he's achieved on the field, and he fully deserves to get those type of rewards off the field now. And he's given something back ultimately as well.
And given something back, I know you've been very busy with your fundraising efforts in recent weeks and months, so people should check out your social media to keep across all that. Also very busy away from football. We've talked about football for the last while, but I know you've lots of other interests away from the football pitch. So we're out of lockdown now. I presume it's going to be a very busy 2020 for the rest of the year.
Well, that's what I hope. I hope that I'm competitive in football for as long as I possibly can be. I hope that, you know, business gets back on track the way I want it to. And I just want, you know, I like living a hectic lifestyle, being busy day to day. And, you know, my wife has a few, I suppose, staycations planned as well. She was down in Tipperary last week where I couldn't go. She's heading to Donegal next week, and I get up for a few days. So things are busy, and that's the way we like life, you know. Nice and hectic, taking the kids to football, going to football myself, and yeah, obviously giving a bit back. And I am currently in the middle of a fundraising campaign to try to raise some much needed funds for Southern Area Hospice Services in Newry and Mourne area. And it's just about raffling a retro Armagh jersey that I have, and trying to, my target was £2,000 sterling, and I don't think I'm too far off that mark at the minute, and all donations are kindly accepted. And to enter the draw for the jersey, all it takes is donate £5 to the Just Giving page, and it goes directly to the charity. So it's nice to be able to give back as much as take in return, you know.
And you'll find all that information, I think, across definitely on Twitter, Stephen, and StephenMcDonald.ie as well. Armagh fans will kill me if I don't ask you about the team before I let you go. So they seem to be going well. One of the most entertaining teams to watch, certainly. Do you think they're almost there in terms of challenging for an Ulster title again?
And yeah, well, that has to be the key. I think Armagh have to be competitive in our own province before we can start looking at the bigger picture again. And Kieran McGeaney has a group of lads there that are eager to play for him, very hungry to play for him, to play a fantastic style of football. And there's no denying that Armagh have some of the most talented forwards in the country at the minute playing in their team. So if we can utilise them and get the best out of them, then challenging for provincial titles can't be too far away. And that's where I'd love to see Armagh obviously back playing Division 1 football again, and that rests within their own hands as well. And if they can do that and come up against the best teams in the country on a weekly basis, then I think we'll be in a better position.
Stephen McDonald, thanks very much.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Missing this?
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this. The all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.